everyone. Welcome to the Delta Flyers. We are a weekly podcast that discusses episodes of Star Trek Voyager in chronological order. Your two fantastic hosts along this podcast journey are myself, Garrett Wong, a.k.a. Ensign Harry Kim, and Robert Duncan McNeil, who portrayed Lieutenant Tom Paris. If you are interested in either an extended version of this podcast or the extended video version of this podcast, both of which include added bonus segments, please check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/TheDeltaFlyers and sign up to become a patron.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Robin. Very good. Very good. You're getting more and more confident. In fact, you're getting so confident. You said the fantastic host
did.
Yeah. That's your feeling. Things. You're feeling very confident about this.
I am. I'm still reading it off of my phone, but I am feeling more confident. The day that I memorize this and don't even have to even look at anything, yeah. I'm going to be super uber duper confident. Yeah. But it's a mouthful, so I don't want to mess it up.
It's good. It's good to have. I think we're finally getting into the flow of this thing now that we've been, what episode is this? Like 14 or 15?
Something like that. Something
whatever like it that. Is. We're like almost, getting close to the end of the first season. We're definitely in a groove.
Yeah.
We are fantastic hosts.
And you're super fan. Well, you're super fantastic because you're about to get a Winnebago. So I think that's pretty exciting.
I know. It's coming soon. It's coming soon.
Yeah, Robbie showed me during our little production meeting not too long ago. Robbie showed me some pictures of the interior of this Winnebago motorhome. What is the name of it? What do
you can call it? A motorhome. You can call it an RV. Some people call them a coach.
Yes.
Some people, motorhome feels like the right thing.
RV stand for recreational vehicle? Or
yeah, recreational vehicle, but but an RV could be a trailer that you tow. It could be a Volkswagen camper. It could be all kinds of things. So a motorhome, motorhome suggests the, this is a nice one. I mean, it's kind of in the middle of sizes and
right.
levels. It's not your basic. But it's a nice motorhome, and I'm excited we get it on Thursday.
Yeah. So in terms of tiers, this is not the AMC Pacer, and this is not the Rolls Royce of cars. You know what I'm saying?
This is the Ford Explorer.
The Ford Explorer of RVs.
It's just it's good.
Right down the middle. But looking at the interior, I'm telling you, it looks very posh to me compared to what we had as trailers, and we had. Big trailers. When
we had nice trailers.
Voyager, yes. Yeah. We had very nice trailers that literally, let's see, we could have slept. Wasn't there like a bunk bed in ours? Didn't we have like a bunk bed in the bed area? It was two single beds, okay, in the sleeping area.
Then
the couch pulled out into like a queen
a double bed,
right? Yeah. And then there was a little kitchenette area.
Yeah.
But that one, we had carpet. And we had like linoleum that was where the kitchen area was. So it was kind of that plasticky kind of And there was a shower, obviously, a little tiny shower and a little toilet. But yours has kind of.
Did you ever shower? Did you ever like use the shower there? I feel like I did like with makeup when we would have like burn makeup or things and I would just jump in or even like stick my head under just to get dirt off if we had dirt.
I think I may have used it only once. I remember the transpo guys saying like, if you need a shower, we need to top off the tank for you because they had to fill up the water tank for us. And so sometimes that thing would be low, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't really rely on it. It wasn't that great of a shower, but I did sleep in that trailer. I did sleep on it on many occasions.
I know you've mentioned
against the law, of course.
You did. You broke. Yeah.
Yeah. I broke some laws. Okay. So congratulations to you on
I'm very excited. It's an exciting sense of upcoming freedom to travel and adventure. Like in my head, this whole RV thing this motorhome thing. It's going to be an adventure, especially during this time where I'm not working because of COVID. And, we may not be going back to work for a couple of months. So still, we've been off for a couple of months. So yeah, it's a nice way to travel and sort of control my environment, be safe, not get on a plane, all those things. You know what? I'm peeking and I see a t-shirt and I just want to,
look at that. For those of you who are just listening on our podcast, Robbie just sort of tilted his camera down towards his The Delta Flyers crew t-shirt. Our merch store is currently up now.
I love this t-shirt. The quality, it's so comfortable. This is somebody that you've used before. Yeah. And I love this design. Rebecca Sims, our amazing graphic designer and artiste, also my girlfriend, Rebecca, designed this shirt, and it's wonderful.
She did it super nice.
I love it. And we got a bunch of different designs that she's done. She did the caricatures of us on the website.
Yeah.
This is like a real official thing we're doing.
The DeltaFlyers.org, I think that's where the address is.
Is it?
I hope that's .org? The correct one. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's so new. I might have just given out the wrong address, but we'll double check before, when we go off and do the rewatch.
Yeah.
This week's episode, Robbie, is called Faces.
Yes. Yes. I'm excited about this.
I'm so excited. I couldn't even sleep last night. I could not. I was turning, tossing, I just because, we're going to have a special guest on later, which is great. We're having Brian Markinson. Faces reminded me of the title of the film, Face Off.
Oh,
remember that movie?
Interesting. And there are some similarities there too.
Well, yeah, there are some similarities. So then I did a little Googling to see who predated who.
Really?
Face Off came out in 97. This episode that we filmed of Faces, we probably filmed in, I'm guessing, early 95. Okay. So I'm wondering, and then it premiered probably during 95 as well.
Yeah,
so
for
I'm
sure.
wondering if the writer of Face Off was watching this episode and thought,
interesting.
I can do something about it. Let's see. Yeah. And so, there we go. Maybe Face Off was born because of Faces. And it does have the whole, in Face Off, of taking off a face and surgically, putting it
the plastic somebody else's surgery. Face.
Surgeon, and, right. Yep. Right. Do you remember who directed that film? That wasn't that, I want to say it was
John Woo.
John Woo. Yeah. I think
was
it was
it John Woo.
Yeah.
I think it might have been too.
The great John Woo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, you
might be right. Maybe there was an inspiration. I do feel like Star Trek, all the different series of Star Trek, have been inspiration for a lot of screenwriters and television writers and actors. I mean, I worked with Christian Slater on a half-hour comedy years ago. He was such a fan of the original series, and he was in one of the movies as a young actor. But he was such a huge Star Trek fan. He bought the captain's chair from one of the movies or something. And he had it at home. And then he told the people in the half hour comedy we were doing, he wanted to put the chair in the show. Like he wanted his character to be a Star Trek fan. So they had it on the set. It was amazing. It inspires a lot of people, this series. So maybe it inspired Face Off. Yes.
I definitely think that's the case. Have you ever met John Woo?
No.
But this guy, I'm telling you right now, I've been a huge fan of his forever. And I'd gone to film festivals before where his films were being showcased and where he was a guest speaker. One of the most, generous, humble directors I've ever met. And so he gets up after the film screens and he says, I'm going to do my John Woo impersonation. He has a very low, gravelly voice. And he says, thank you all for coming to watch my film. I want to tell everyone that I spend a lot of time in pre-production working on this. And if you have any questions about this film or filmmaking, there is a email address at the end of your program. You can see, you can go ahead and email me and I will answer you. And I'm thinking, what? So I'm jokingly thinking I would email John Woo and say, dear John, I'm having problems with my girlfriend right now. What do you recommend?
Any questions at all?
Yeah, any questions. And he's like, well, if your girlfriend is not paying enough attention to you, maybe you should move on. There are plenty of fish in this sea. So don't think that this girl is the only one for you. So then I really, you know, got into this whole thing of like, this guy's amazing. So I had that meeting, and then the bottom line is, you know, he's like, my children watch Star Trek. They like you.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's like, but these are the dates we are shooting. Do you think you have the time to do this? We would need this much time from you. And I was like, well, and you know how much time we put into Voyager. We had no free time. We had like a week off, literally. So we couldn't make the schedule work. So
yeah.
So the John Woo, Garrett Wong connection never happened, unfortunately.
Yeah. That's amazing that he's that open to civilians or anyone.
To anyone, Robbie. And he said, literally, if you have any questions about this film or anything to do with filmmaking. Oh, and the best thing was this. Someone yelled out. He goes, you're the master. I mean, you're the genius or something like that. He goes, oh, please. No, I am still a student of film. You know, I am still, I am still learning. Yeah, please do not call me the master. I am learning still. And I'm like, no, you're the master to me. So very humble. So, all right. So on that note.
All right.
For those of you who are our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned while we play a game called What Do We Remember? Everybody else listening to our podcast, Robbie and I are going to go rewatch this episode Faces and come right back with our analysis and our special guest. What do you remember from Faces?
Did David Livingston direct this one too? I feel like David Livingston directed it. No?
I don't think so.
Oh, gosh. I'm not making... This is not a very good start, is it?
That's okay.
Wow. David Livingston didn't direct... Are you sure? Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
I guess the reason I think it's David Livingston is because I do remember, like, visually it was... There was a lot of cool shots.
I just looked it up. It's directed by our favorite German.
Oh, Rick Colby. Well, Rick also shoots very cool shots. David Livingston always did weird stuff. That's probably why I thought it was him.
Yeah.
Okay, Rick Colby directed it. Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good. Rick was always great for our cast. He really was, the actors loved when he directed. He was our first director with the pilot. So, yeah, I remember it was a big episode for Roxanne.
Yeah.
I feel like, who wrote this? It couldn't have been Brian Fuller because he wasn't on the show yet.
No.
But it was somebody like that. It was like, it was the first episode, shockingly enough, that I remember, like, a lot of conversations ahead of shooting it.
Okay.
I remember, like, Roxanne was talking a lot about it. Maybe because there was tests for her to play herself for double, you know, he had to do some doubling, right? Didn't she have to do like,
oh yeah.
And she took her makeup, like she had no makeup in one and full Klingon in the other. Right.
Yep. So they that's right. Yeah. So you remember this one pretty well.
I remember that. I don't remember what I did. Well, I tell you what I do remember, because Brian Markinson is a friend of mine in real life. I know that I had scenes with Brian because he told me that.
Yeah, he told you that when you were directing Girlfriends.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, I was on Voyager. He was guest starred on Voyager. I was like, oh, wow, what episode? He goes, a couple episodes of it. Faces was the big one. He goes, and I had scenes with you. Like, we had scenes together, big scenes. And I was like, oh. So I know that because Brian told me, but not because... I remember it on my very big boy self. No, I did not remember my big boy self.
He's like, we shared scenes together. We had milkshakes off camera. Do you remember that? I mean, God.
Whatever. There must be like a vitamin or an herb that I could take for my brain memory. If anybody out there has memory herb suggestions, and when I say herb, don't go with the, we're going to get more weed or maybe less weed. No, I don't need any of that. None of that joke. But if there's a vitamin that'll help my brain stuff, please, message us.
You're a car guy. Well, you know cars fairly well, I think. I know you know motorcycles, but yes. What is that thing that you, that's, is it the inhibitor chip? Something that stops cars from going faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have that in your head.
In my, yeah, I have an
memories.
A memory inhibitor.
A memory inhibitor chip in your head.
So I think I do.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I remember this being, I mean, if you read the Netflix little tiny blurb, it's the shortest one of all. Paris, okay. Torres, and Durst are imprisoned by the Vidians, period. So that's it. So it's very
Paris,
quick.
Paris, Torres, and Durst.
Durst oh, there are you go. Imprisoned so, by the Vidians.
So right? That's Brian. We're all three of us are in prison, and then they take her and experiment on her or something.
Yeah, yeah. But just it's this was a huge episode for her. I remember watching it when it premiered on television, and just sitting there and thinking, "Wow,
great opportunity! What a
tour
for
de force! A tour de force performance for Roxanne Biggs Dawson."
Yeah.
I remember really getting into this episode.
Yeah, I do too.
I'm just looking forward to rewatching it now to remember all the nitty gritty and all the details, you know, that I've forgotten since then. So that's it.
Yeah. Me. I remember the makeup was, I'd never seen anything quite like it because they take all these different aliens that they catch along, you know, out in the Delta Quadrant, and they steal their body parts, right? They harvest their body parts. And so I remember that makeup for the Vidians was just really one of a kind. I'd never seen anything like it. And that was very cool.
Yeah. You know, and as far as alien adversaries, you know, go, these guys, they're right up there, you know, with the Borg and with Species 8472, with everything else that we encounter, these guys are right up there because, number one, they're very, very menacing or just difficult to look at with all the crazy stuff going on. Number one.
Yep.
Number two, they're so much more advanced than we are, right? Their civilization has been around so much longer than Earth has, and really their technology is leaps and bounds ahead of what we have, and so that also makes them so dangerous because you don't know what can happen, right? Because we saw the prior episode, all he did was aim his little phaser at Neelix, and Neelix's lungs
took
were
his
gone.
Lungs.
He just beamed his lungs out in 0.2 seconds, and it was just like what? So very scary, you know. Just the horror movie sort of element of this is also kind of something. Yeah. That gets you too. So, but in a good way, you know.
Yeah.
You're definitely glued to the screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Let's go. I'm excited.
Let's go watch this.
Let's go watch it, and then we're going to come back here. Brian Markinson is going to join us, and we're going to recap what we see.
All right, guys, we are back from rewatching the episode Faces, and let's just give a round of applause to our guest, Mr. Brian Markinson. Yes,
Brian,
thank you so much for being here.
Good job.
So happy to be here.
Very good job in that
we
episode.
We have Durst. It. Yeah, it was
Durst slash Sulan.
Sulan, exactly. Sulan, chief surgeon of the Vidian Solidality.
Chief surgeon? You went to
Solidality.
A lot of medical school to get there.
A lot of medical school, exactly.
Your parents must have been so proud.
They were.
Mr.
Look, do you
Mrs.
see
Sulan.
Everything's cleared up? A little bit of Clearasil and that's...
just a little cream.
No more phage.
You look amazing. So this episode, just to recap, this story was by Jonathan Glasner and Ken Biller. Teleplay by Ken Biller. Whether he's credited as Kenneth Biller. I have a question, Robbie. Was Ken Biller on the writing staff that early?
He was a story editor. He was a protege. I think he was a protege of Michael Piller, who was one of the creators of our show.
Yeah.
Michael had come from CBS development. He was an executive at CBS, Michael Piller, and then went into writing from the executive side of things. Ken Biller took a similar path. Ken was working as an executive at maybe CBS, but I know he had been an executive and then started writing. And I think Michael sort of mentored him a bit. So he was a story editor the first season.
Okay, gotcha.
He became the executive producer showrunner by season 7.
Correct.
But this season, first season, he was at the very
Lower on the totem pole.
Bottom.
He was at the bottom rung of writers. He's the story editor. Okay.
Yep.
This episode was directed by Vinish Colby, otherwise known as Rick Colby. We all
love
it.
Was not David Livingston like I thought before we watched it. It's Rick Colby.
Who has since passed away. I don't know if we talked about that at all.
I don't think we have.
Did you know that, Brian, that Rick Colby
passed away? I didn't.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He was a lovely guy.
He really was.
For those that haven't seen it in a while, Faces is an episode where we're still stuck in the Delta Quadrant. We're trying to head home. And an away team of Durst, played by Brian Markinson, Tom Paris, and Belana Torres, has stopped to explore some mountains or something, I think she says. And they've gone to a different part of that planet. And now they're coming back to get us. But when they come back, there are no signs of them. They can't find any life signs on the planet where they left them. And in fact, the tunnels where they had left them have completely changed. So they're baffled. They're like, how can the tunnels change? Anyway, what turned out is down deep in this planet are Vidians hiding out. They have, as we learned in earlier episodes, Vidians have incredible technology, technology that can create force fields that change tunnels. So that's what they're doing. They're hiding out down there. And there is a chief surgeon, Sulan, who is also played by Brian Markinson, who is, from the very beginning, we see that Belana Torres is a prisoner, but she has been split, her genetic makeup has been split in two, and she's full Klingon is one part of her, and there's a physically another part that's full human, like Jekyll and Hyde, two sides of the story. And Sulan is looking for a cure for phage and thinks Klingons may have it, which it looks like they do. And he not only thinks she's heroic and amazing, but he starts to kind of fall in love with her, have some feelings for her. In the meantime, Paris and Durst are trying to survive. And they bring Durst in because Sulan has fallen in love with Belana, but he thinks he's too ugly and wants to be more attractive. So he takes Durst's face, puts it on his face, and he's like, now do you love me, Belana? And it's gross, which we'll talk about all that. And so he's heartbroken because his really smart idea to steal somebody's face and put it on so the girl will like him, which we've all done, let's admit it.
Have we?
Wait, inside voice. Chakotay and the captain come up with a plan. Chakotay, with the doctor's help, takes on a Vidian disguise and is beamed in a very complicated sciencey way, beamed in quickly to rescue everybody. And there's a little shootout, and they are ultimately rescued. And the big part of the story is Belana dealing with the two sides of her personality, coming to terms with accepting who she is, even the Klingon part, which she's always kind of rejected emotionally most of her life. So there's some great performances by Roxanne and Brian, and it's a really exciting episode. So that's anything else to add there?
Well, I love how you conveniently leave out everything that Kim does to help out in this. He's the one that finds the microfractures. He helps a lot in the science of it. He's the one that comes up with the transponders, breadcrumbs, right. And the breadcrumbs part of it, Robbie, that is Kim's warp particles because he comes up with this whole, you know, subspace.
Well, he goes, breadcrumbs. And the captain's like, hey, pardon me?
Exactly.
Pardon me, Mr. Kim?
I want to draw light to your interesting pronunciation of Brian's character in this. You pronounced it similar to Disney's Mulan, and you called him Sulan. And I think it's
Sulan.
I think Sulan. I think.
Ah.
Boy named Sue. I mean, Sue.
Sulan.
Sue. Or Sulan.
Sulan. Oh.
Sulan. The L is silent.
I think I'm from the South, so I give it a little extra.
You get
it. Sulan.
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 I don't think I ever said it.
No.
You did say it once.
You said it in the beginning. You said, I'm. Yeah.
I am Sulan.
That's right. I am Sulan. I think I said Sulan.
Okay. You did have a very theatrical accent, though, in this, which I was very impressed with. The two characters And I thought it was really well done.
What was your experience or exposure to Star Trek before you were cast in this role?
Well, like everybody who was a child of the 60s, as a kid, I saw the original series. Yeah. And was a fan, but not, I don't think I would have considered myself a Trekkie. Mm-hmm. And then Rick and the gang would bring me in. I did an episode called Homebound from Next Gen. So I had, they knew me, they would bring me in. I think I might've auditioned for Neelix when they were casting this originally. They would bring me in for, you know, like anything, anybody that they could cover in prosthetics. So I got to play those roles, being a, you know, Robbie and I come from a similar background. We're New York theater boys.
Yeah.
So that's what it was. But the whole Shakespeare, the more standard, it had to do with the fact that I was, you know, I had false teeth. I was in a plastic bag for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
I was blind. I had opaque contact lenses in. And so you had to over enunciate. It was difficult to hear myself. So I just sort of pretended I was doing Cyrano.
Did you have to loop or do ADR for that role because of the teeth and things?
I don't recall. I don't think I had to do much. I mean, those guys, they're such pros.
Yeah.
And there was not much. I don't know how much looping you had to do. I don't believe I did. I did have a tendency, maybe I did, because I had a tendency with those teeth in after a while to, you have to sort
get
of
extra spit
a little bit. Extra spit.
I wondered about you. I wondered about Roxanne when she was in the Klingon because of the big teeth.
Yeah, you could tell that too.
Yeah. And normally there is kind of a bit of the spit, and you can tell when someone's got mouthpieces in. It didn't. Your enunciation was great. The speech was very clean. And same with Roxanne. That's why I wondered if you guys both had to ADR quite a bit of that.
I don't think we did. And I said to Rick when I came in, it was weird because I was cast as Sulan. I read for Sulan back for Cathexis because they knew they needed to cast a guy that they were going to take his face.
Yeah.
So there you go. I asked him first if it was cool to sort of take that.
Yeah.
You know, and he was an educated guy.
Yeah, for sure. You know,
so why not?
I thought it was wonderful. I thought it in terms of status, you know, sometimes when I acted and when I direct, you know, I use status as a tool to play with characters, who's high status, who's low status. And something about that archetype of the educated surgeon, you know, head surgeon, all of those things with the language, the way you were speaking it, it sort of gave him some status and some import that I thought was, I thought it was a great choice, and you did.
Well,
a great
thanks. I'm glad it came across because I was deaf and blind for, I was Helen Keller for a lot of it.
I did one episode that comes up in future seasons, Threshold was the name of it, which is one of the most hated episodes of all Star Trek. But I turned into a lizard, and then I kidnapped the captain, turned her into a lizard, and we had lizard babies. And then we abandoned them on the planet. But anyway, I had the same, like, completely covered like you did. In fact, because I was turning into this lizard in real time on the show, they put these bladders in the prosthetic so that the head would go.
That's wicked.
They had tubes that went to the floor. So not only was that thing on my face, but all I heard was. Like, that's what I heard. I couldn't hear the other actors. I had to look at their lips because all I heard was these airbags going.
Yeah, all that acting school, all that training, and you're and really you're just trying to be heard, man.
Yeah.
And a quick shout out to the great Michael Westmore, because
I
mean, I got to, you know, that was very exciting for me to be able to sit in a chair and have them throw plaster on my head for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And he was there doing it. So
he's a master. Yeah. He
a
really
legend.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just to elaborate a little bit more on what you said earlier, Brian, about you had that experience with TNG. There's definitely a group of actors that were brought in to constantly audition for all the Trek projects, such as Tim Russ was one of these people. Yep. You know, has done many different incarnations of Trek. Jeffrey Combs has done, you know, every Trek known to man practically. You went in for TNG. They brought you in for Neelix. So there is this core of actors that I think that the Trek management or the big wigs would always call up and say, let's bring him in for this. And
yeah, I did Deep Space Nine too.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah. Yeah. Dorn's directorial debut.
Oh, really?
Was it really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was he nervous? Was he all?
He was nervous. But
it's nerve wracking. It's crazy. In that generation, our generation, the Voyager, the Deep Space Nine,
TNG,
TNG, Enterprise, all of that. Yeah. There definitely was sort of a type of actor that the studio liked to hire. You know, now it's funny. I just started watching Picard. I'll be honest. I just started watching Picard, and it's really interesting. I'm fascinated by it, actually. But it's really interesting to see Patrick Stewart, who sort of is one of those actors of that old generation, that type of actor.
Well, theater trained, yeah.
Theater trained, and obviously a legend as Picard. But many of the other actors that they're bringing in around him are not the same type of actor that would have been hired back in the 90s. So it's kind of interesting, like sometimes it works and sometimes I'm like, wow, you feel the change in management, you know, that creatively they've kind of shifted gears to a different style, and so it's interesting. But yeah, back then there was a type for sure, type of actor.
For sure.
Did the producers and the writers ask you to watch the earlier episode Phage, which introduces the Vidians, as preparation for your work as Sulon? Did you do that?
They did not.
Really?
You know, but Gary, you know why they didn't?
Yeah.
They did not have it done. Like,
Was it not? Oh, it wasn't even ready at the time.
They wouldn't get those episodes done.
Okay.
I mean, how far before? I'm bad at math, but it was only three or four episodes before Cathexis, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it was probably still in the midst of post-editing. No effects were done. It just wasn't.
Because the two guest stars that played Vidians in that episode have a very similar type of voice quality to what you end up evoking on this episode. It's much more stylized, more theatrical, and also lighter in tone. Like, I found the one Vidian head guard to be so standing out from everything else because he had this very low resonant, almost like Klingon like voice, right? And then everyone else is talking like this, you know, and that's how the original Vidians were that we met in Phage. They had very theatrical and almost voices that
colorful,
but they were weak also from the Phage. You know, the voices came off as being affected by that.
From the outside looking at that, looking at the episode this morning.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm not big at watching myself, no matter what. I've done 400 something, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very rare that I watch it. But, you know, I saw a weak man. I saw a man who was... even though educated in terms of stature, in terms of the way he carried himself, it wasn't prideful. It was more subversive in a weird way.
You had your head cocked often to the side, which I thought was interesting that, you know, and the way that the makeup sort of fell in with it. I don't know if it was conscious or unconscious, but it fits what your choice you were describing was.
That's mainly sort of, because Roxanne was on the table.
Yeah, that's probably
most of the time. Do that. And so, as opposed to, it looked, you know.
But I felt it was a little bit with the makeup and the disease and all of it. It just felt a little bit like weight heavy, you know?
Yeah. Heavy. I mean, but that's, it was simply because so I could look at her in a way. And then and Rick never said anything.
No, that didn't
bug me.
I'm
one of these guys. Yeah, no, but I'm one of these guys. I try to be as subjective as possible and not direct myself and trust who's behind the camera that if I'm doing something strange, they'll say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
The casting process, was it pretty quick? Were they just like, okay, we're going to have you come in, read for us, and let's do this? Or did they just offer it to you right off?
It was very, very simple. It was Junie and...
Brad?
And who else? Who's the spec? He had specs.
I think his name was Brett. No, Robbie McNeil.
No,
what was his name?
That guy's name was Ron Surma.
Ron Surma! Wow.
Thank you.
Garrett.
I'm going to be both you and Brian's memory banks right now.
Yes, thank you.
You're younger, more virile. All better right. looking
so,
version.
So Junie and Ron were there, right? And then what
yeah,
else?
Yeah, and producers were there, and they knew me. So it really was just a quick read, and I think I was cast.
Probably within a day or so, that day.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. They moved pretty fast.
The name Durst, who decided? Does anyone know who came up? Because the only Durst I know is Fred Durst, the lead singer of that band, Limp Bizkit. One of the writers, a big Limp Bizkit fan. Is that why they chose Durst?
Ken Miller wrote it. I wonder.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Who knows? I mean, did you remember? Did anyone come up to you and say, well, you know, we decided on the name to be Durst because fill in the blank. No. Yeah. We find out your first name in this episode. It's Pete.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I say right. it, don't
you,
I?
You do. You do. Yeah. Hey, Pete.
They talk about that they're in the Avery, that you guys, that we are in the Avery system, which I wonder, was that a nod to Avery Brooks subtly? I don't know. I mean, that's
what I don't know.
Here in the start, you know, the captain's log in the very beginning. So I don't know. I just threw that out there.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, you know, to think back in the context of what was going on back then. And yeah, some of these names or some of those little details, like, you know, a lot of fans know this, but. But on the all the buttons on the ship are usually three letters. Usually, it's like three letters plus three, so six letters altogether. Three and then a break and then three. The letters are the first three names of a crew member's first name and the first three letters of the crew member's last name. So as you look around at the buttons, you can go, "Oh, there's R-I-C-B-E-R. That's Rick Berman."
Mm.
Or there's K-E-N. B-I-L, that's Ken Biller.
Ken Biller. Yeah.
So they're all, every button on the ship
has a meaning.
Was built into the crew list, you know, our grips and our electrics and our writers and our everybody.
Little Easter eggs for
little Easter
for
eggs. So I'm sure that, I'm sure the names that they picked for this stuff had to have Easter eggs that, you know.
I would imagine. You should stop bringing schlub actors on and get the producers, writers in here.
They'll
give you the real skinny. No,
this is good. This is so good. All right. Anything else, Brian, that you can think of before we get into the story and the episode, like the casting, the getting the makeup developed or, you know?
It was mainly for me. It was pretty quick, and it was the joy of sitting in there with tubes stuffed up my nose, talking to Michael Westmore for 3 hours. But I had no idea. They didn't even show me photographs of Adean. They just said heavy prosthetics.
yes.
Was that the heaviest prosthetics you've had of all the prosthetics you've done?
I've done a few, but that was way up there.
What was the hour count for getting that whole thing done? Was it 3, 4, 5 hours? How long?
They got better and better at it as they do. But I think it was 2.5, 3 hours.
Oh my
Seems
God.
About right.
Yeah, they.
Did you do the life cast up in the shop, which was
down
that alley and you go up the stairs and then,
So,
they would do a lot of.
I mean, and that Paramount, man. I mean, it's like, that workshop's been there forever.
Yeah.
For any cinephile and anybody, I mean, I don't know if, did they shoot all the original there too, didn't they? Or did?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, who knows who
we're seeing. I think it was Desi Lu. I think they were on the other side of the lot. Desi Lu.
Studios, yeah.
Yeah, Desi Lu bought RKO Studios, which used to be on the Gower side, Paramount. Yeah. And then there was a wall, and Paramount was on the other side of the wall. And then when Paramount bought Desi Lu, they took the wall down and had a big studio.
Just like Berlin.
Yes. Finally, the wall at Paramount fell.
It's down!
Freedom!
Exactly. You had guys scrambling it over and shot all the time.
As soon as that first shot started with Roxanne revealing her Klingon look, I thought the whole teaser was one shot. Rick Colby did a beautiful job of revealing, you know, making it cinematic. And he was just a super talented director. I thought as soon as that first shot happened, I'm like, all right, I'm in. It's dynamic. It's cool. Look at her. She's a Klingon.
And so reminiscent of Mary Shelley's Dr. Frankenstein, really creating his, you know, yeah. and I love, Brian, how at the end you're like, Belana Torres, you know, wake up. I mean, you almost whisper that. And it's just, didn't take the over the top, wake up, you know, I am Dr. Frankenstein. I mean, it was just the right amount of cadence and voice breath that you had, and it was brilliant, and it sucks the viewer in, and it's just right there. You're like,
well, it's
oh
a beautifully
God.
Fluid shot. If you can tell a story in one, as Robbie knows, tell it in one, man.
Yeah,
I mean, why wouldn't you?
I just thought the shot was great. I loved what you did there in the background, letting it all play as one thing and being very mysterious.
Yeah, we don't, the shot, if as I recall, you don't see me, right?
No.
You just see a piece of me, and it's all about her.
Yeah. It is.
And that must have been shocking for the fandom too, hey?
Oh, yeah.
To see where are we, what are we doing? It's
I remember Roxanne was very anxious about this episode.
Okay.
She did not have confidence that this was a good episode.
Really?
Yeah.
Her work in it, in the scenes with you, we'll get to him, I think is, those scenes are beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful and human and full and rich. Do you think she was more anxious about playing the full Klingon self?
I think maybe about, she didn't want to go into all the makeup and do all that. She knew that doing the evil twin shots where you've got to do doubles and stuff, it's just a lot of, but I don't think it was the resistance to the challenge of the hours and the work. I think it was a resistance to like the character's feelings about racism and race. And, you know, it was a lot about that. I don't know that she wanted to shine a light so hard and so, you know, concretely on that. But I think she was wrong. I think by the end, my memory is by the end of shooting it, she was actually very proud of the work she did. And I think she saw the value in the story.
And boy, is it resonant now, hey? I mean,
like
watching it today, how can you not feel in those monologues and in those scenes with the two of you, very moving stuff.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I think that the anxiety that she had was that this story was really hitting home for her a lot because I'm going to say this, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Her maiden name is she's of Puerto Rican descent. Her mother and her father are both Puerto Rican. Her last name is Caballero. That's her last name. But she never, in the 7 years that I was on the show, she never really talked about, we had this great Puerto Rican, blah, blah. She never made reference to her own ethnic background. So I almost feel like there's a little bit of, you know, and this is something that I faced as well, being Asian American, and she's Puerto Rican American, is that as an American, this country has traditionally kind of marginalized those that are people of color. You know, we definitely feel like there are people that have made me feel like a second class, third class, and sometimes a fourth class citizen with their comments and their racial epithets. And I think maybe Roxanne also dealt with the same thing. So as a child, I was always trying to be less Asian and more white, you know, and just sort of like, you know, distance myself from who I was. And I think I'm going to make this same guess that Roxanne really tried to distance herself from her Puerto Rican, her Latina background. And this episode is exactly all about that. You know, it's about her talking about growing up as a Klingon with her Klingon mother on that colony where they were the only Klingons and they were different. And one of the things I remember my mom telling me when I came back from preschool, kindergarten, whatever it was, and she said, "How was your day?" I answered her question with the question. I asked my mother, "Why am I different?" is what I said as a, you know, 4-year-old. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is a huge theme in this episode.
Yeah.
And so I really feel that maybe the anxiety she had was when she was reading the script, she's like, "Oh my gosh, this is kind of like my life, you know, in real life, you know, dealing with that."
Too close to home.
Yeah. Or maybe I'm wrong. Like for me, I'll talk about, "Oh, Chinese New Year's coming up." You know, I'll make some mention about my cultural background, but she never said anything about her own. So that's what makes me wonder if that's why the anxiety.
Well, I think there's a little piece of us in every character we do, especially if you're a series regular. It's natural. The writers start to write to the actor, you know?
Everything that this episode pivots on in terms of shame and race and acceptance and fear and bearing your fear and courage, you know, this is a throwback to that 60s series where moralistically everything, I was so impressed with it.
Yeah, I was too.
Watching it now, you know? Yeah.
I do remember though, Roxanne was she was resistant. And then I remember it's the only time, and I did a lot of scenes with Roxanne over the years, but it's the only episode I remember Roxanne before shooting day coming up to me and saying, "Hey, can we talk about these scenes and maybe read them and rehearse them?" And I'm trying to, and I remember seeing her script and she had so many lines crossed out and new pitches. Like we never changed dialogue on that show. Like the script was, you said every of this, that period. Mm-hmm. And I remember specifically on that episode, Roxanne had rewritten a lot and crossed things out. And I don't know if she, won those battles, you know, I don't know, but I knew that it was part of her process to say, let me rework this so that it feels better. And now I'm going to go tell the writers, can we do this? And I believe she got a lot of those changes.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, you know, that struggle is part of the process and that banging, sometimes you have to bang your head against that wall for a while, but on the other side of it, we get this beautiful, textured, very, 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 this performance filled with gravitas that she brings in those scenes. Really remarkable.
Yeah.
And both of you guys were there. Was that her stunt double that would be in scenes with her or her stand-in? Who was that other person?
I forget the woman's name, but there was a double that did the Klingon, full Klingon for the wide shots when it was 50-50. And I noticed, I remember, because I was shadowing, I was going to work and watching Rick Colby direct because I was interested in directing. So I remember being there for some of these scenes.
Okay.
How'd that work out for you?
I'm still trying to learn.
Okay, go ahead.
How John Woo of you?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So if you notice, I remember Marvin Rush talking about this, that when it was the wide shots and the double would come down and move around, they were lighting it darker so that you wouldn't see the double. And if you look at the cut in those shots, the full Klingon version of B'Elanna is a little in shadow, so it protects for those wide shots where they had a double.
There is one shot where they chose for an over the, would you say
the
full
double.
Klingon? Would you say full, you never go full Klingon. But they did. But as opposed to going over the double, they shot the close-up of her profile. And you could see that they had different noses.
And the lips were also a little bit different too.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there was a few shots in there where you could tell it was not Roxanne in both images, but
you know, that scene in the cave where they're talking back and forth to each other, and usually it would be a single, but there was one point where Roxanne, full Klingon, is about to leave, and she's pissed off, and she starts mouthing, she says the line, and obviously Roxanne had to loop that part, so it was literally the double saying the line. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Because now it's a two shot. You see Klingon, full Klingon, fake Roxanne, whatever, walking out, and she's up. So I thought, oh wow, they actually included that, and they had to have her loop.
Yeah,
but it wasn't jarring. I mean, we've seen it 1,000 times, and I thought that it furthered the story, and I bought it.
Yeah, I bought it too. Yeah. I did.
So Neelix is given Tuvok some soup, some traditional Vulcan soup.
Oh yes.
And I just gotta say, why is Tuvok such a jerk? Like Neelix is—he's so proud of this soup. He's made this from his. I mean, yeah. So he made it a little too spicy, but Tuvok didn't know that yet. Like, why not say thank you? Like, why not be nice? Why is everybody so mean to Neelix all the time when he's just trying to make people happy?
And it didn't bug him, though. Soup. It didn't bug Neelix. And then at the end, that wonderful part with Johnny Phillips sitting there, Ethan Phillips is sitting there, and he takes a sip of that. He drinks it himself.
He drinks it out of the bowl.
And that whole, like, oh, yeah, just like home or whatever.
Just like home. And then he burped or something.
He burps, which was classic, right?
Yeah, it was very
funny.
And
now we know that that Tom Paris loves PB&J, peanut butter and jelly. And then...
Awesome choice.
And then, of course, for Chakotay, what do they do? They say that his favorite is corn salad. So is this another stretch at him being Native American and having at maize, as we call it?
Yes.
I mean, what the hell? I mean,
Brian, you haven't been part of my whole first season of this show. I've been ranting about the horrible, offensive, stereotypical racism that they threw at this character of Chakotay. Without any real tribe or real authenticity. The props looked like bad souvenirs from Disneyland. Like, you know, it's just
very stereotypical. And it's just like whatever they decided. Like in one part they're referencing maybe one specific tribe, and then all of a sudden you see stuff from like Incan and Mayan, you know, and it's just like there's so many different elements that they just throw out there and just like, hey, whatever, we'll go.
And I have to say, what is so incredibly refreshing that we have to go back into the 90s to see what a beautiful, beautiful tapestry that this franchise has always weaved in terms of race and gender. And it was great to see. It's great to see Kate Mulgrew. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
they
were ahead of their time in terms of that.
Yeah.
Not that I don't disagree with. Sometimes you get ham-fisted trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, it's always imperfect. I mean, I guess the lesson for me here is like, you're right. They did so many good things in the 90s that were ahead of their time. And so they were imperfect. We're always going to be imperfect, but we keep trying. We just got to keep trying to be better and do better.
Absolutely, man. I mean, here we are.
Brian, thank you for being glasses half full on that and bringing it up, because it's, it is so true. Because Robbie is sitting here, he's half empty on the whole thing. Right?
It's out of context. And I did want to just bring a different perspective, because I haven't been with you guys this season. And just to see it, that's one of the first things I noticed. It's like every character, there's just this, it's the world that we live in, the world that is where you guys live in right now.
Yeah, it is true.
Canada, pal.
It is truly the most diverse of Star Trek cast of that time. More than DS9. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? If you think that.
Yeah.
Across the board, it was literally, Star Trek was just like, watch this, guys. We're going to have all the main characters of all these, people of color that you never see, and we're going to showcase it. So as bad as the Chakotay representation can be, and as offensive as it is from our eyes in 2020, when we watched this, still for mid-90s, boy, that was groundbreaking. Really was. So we do. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, Brian. It's true. Yeah. Sometimes we have to look at the glasses half full. So.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. I'm moving on. All right. We got to keep moving. We got a long episode.
Yeah, let's go.
Keep going.
So Janeway, I noticed, has gone back in this episode with her hairdo to the big poofy bouffant bun. Like for a while, it was changing. Like the first season, every episode, it was a different version of a updo, and they were all better than this one.
This is the matronly grandmother. Yeah. I called this the bun of steel, is what I said. The bun of steel. And I would joke about how I would say at conventions, I would say that, if someone said, oh, Captain, the turbolift doors are broken, I'd say, stand aside. Let me do it. And she bends forward like a battering ram and uses her head to,
It's a weapon.
It's a weapon. So I don't like it either. Not good.
I was very disappointed that we went. I mean, I know that particular bun, I guess, was the survivor, because it kind of, that was the most common look, I think, right? For the first couple of years.
It kept resurfacing. It was like a cockroach. You just can't get rid of them, right? It keeps going out.
That particular bun.
That particular bun. She had some others that were, like last week on was it Cathexis? That's awesome. Whatever last week was, she had a really cool, like it was tight. It looked feminine. It looked sexy, but it was strong. It was like, it was good. It was good.
Robbie,
and she wasn't vain about that stuff. Hey, I mean,
they just threw this on her. One day she'd show up and they'd try this, and Robbie, we should start making designations like bun 3A, bun 4, we should have different bun designations. This is ridiculous.
There was an executive named Carrie McCluggage. I don't know if you remember that name, Brian.
But Carrie, he was head of Paramount Television.
Yeah, he was head of the Paramount Television Group. And Carrie's big thing, he had perfect hair himself. And his big, like the big, most important thing to him always was hairstyles on his TV shows.
Yeah, he said, if you can't get the script right, if you can't get, if all things are wrong, just make sure one thing is right. Get the hair right. So he was all about hair. Everyone's hair had to be.
And he always had opinions. And I think that it was Carrie McCluggage probably just not feeling like, satisfied with any of these looks. Can we, he probably had notes like, can we see a different bun? Like,
yeah.
Maybe try.
Sounds like he had a bit of a fetish.
Maybe he did.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Everybody's got their thing.
Everybody's got their thing.
Mine's baseball hats.
Yeah. You don't want to know mine.
How funny would that be if we found out after the fact that Carrie McCluggage has all the wigs of Janeway at his house like that, and he's just taking them. He's like, "Oh yes, here's this one. I love this one." And then he's like this hair fetish guy.
All right, so then we go to the bridge. Yes. We go to the bridge, and there's a and they're heading back. And is it Tuvok that sees the caves have moved, or is it you,
Garrett? You're always discounting the fact that Kim is.
I know. I'm always trying.
I'm pretty sure it was Kim.
I think it was Kim.
Yeah.
But the point of this is, the caves are moving, and then you scream out, breadcrumbs. And she's like, what?
Tourette's.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Tourette's. You have a Tourette's moment.
Yeah, and, following Neelix.
But you come up with this idea, which is very, very clever. So just, again, you're coming up with good ideas.
Thank you. Subspace transponders, drop those down to help facilitate an emergency beam out if we need it. I mean, I just remember this episode was just mouthful of technobabble for Ensign Kim. It was like, bleh, bleh.
You had one line there on the bridge, and I meant to write it down and quote it. It was a very difficult line, but I didn't because I was into the episode and I was watching. Yeah. But I was like, oh, that's a good one to use as an example of very hard technobabble. You did.
Yeah.
You had a bunch of it. Yeah, you did rock it. It was tough.
Yeah.
All right. So bun of steel. Yep. Breadcrumbs. And then we went back over to Sulan and Roxanne and B'Elanna. One thing I noticed that was very interesting was Roxanne really transformed into... I noticed her Klingon, her performance of a full Klingon, the tempo and the cadence of the words, the way she broke things up was so different. And I was not a fan of Star Trek when we started this show. I would not have known if they had asked me to play a Klingon. I'm curious. I don't have the answer, but I wonder what Roxanne did to model that performance on, because it really was transformative for her as an actress, and she did a great job.
Yeah, I thought she did too.
Yeah. I would venture to say she probably did a lot of research. She's very thorough. She probably researched it. And also the cadence changed because of the teeth too. That sort of lent to the different delivery, the pacing of her lines, the dialogue was partially because of those teeth. But yes, she did embrace her Klingonness as full as anyone would have, right? Mm-hmm. So very impressive.
So I had one note that I wrote down talking about the contradiction and the juxtaposition of the high tech and the antiquated. So here we've got these Vidians who are like, he has this incredible Genitron, but he has to...
When he said Genitron, I was like, that's a cheesy name.
But also, he has to aim it like a dentist's x-ray machine. It's like, don't you have buttons, remotes for that? Can't you just go, and then it's there? But no, I had to bring it out. Turn your head. We're gonna get your right bicuspid.
Maybe he wasn't really the head surgeon. Maybe he was an orthodontist.
I think he was an orthodontist.
Maybe B'Elanna, a little to the left, please.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now don't move. Now he goes out of the room and hits the button.
That's funny.
Oh my God. Well, throughout the scene, there's a couple of those things they're talking about. It's like you're 1,000 years in the future, and yet they haven't cured male pattern baldness.
That was a cool set, though. I remember when I was shadowing, because I didn't have any scenes, I guess at the very end, but I didn't really have any scenes in that set per se, but I was watching and observing Rick Colby, and I was just so impressed with that set. And in fact, I think I made a note about the prison set when you were doing the role of Durst, and you were in the prison set. That was a great set too. It was really
cool.
The way that they had the grates and the lighting, and I always, from a broad strokes aesthetic, I always enjoyed the episodes where you had those kind of really textured, dark, sets, as opposed to these sort of brightly lit, main street of a planet that looks like a shopping mall. Those kind of sets were not my...
How many stages did you guys have? Because you would, because for these sort of special set pieces that they would create, I mean, those guys, it's amazing. They would build it, tear it down, and move something else in.
Yeah.
They usually built our swing sets, things like that, either on stage 16
or nine.
We used to have the room to build a corner of that. That's where sick bay was. Engineering, and then there was a corner that eventually became the holodeck.
Just all swings, yeah. Okay.
And so they bring swing sets over there.
Yeah. I love the scene when you guys are being herded into the barracks area, and that one Vidian guard shoves Brian in the back like that, and he falls into, and just it really reminded me of like a Scooby-Doo cartoon, like Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo, because like the height difference and you turn around and Scrappy-Doo is always trying to get into a fight and Brian turns around and tries to tussle with the guy. And then Robbie says, just remember, they're the ones with the guns.
Like that's that. That's one of my do-overs. My son saw me do that. My son's trained in boxing. And when he pushed me and I went back at, they were like, can I say what they said? How G-rated is this? It's like, Dad, you fight like a bitch. Oh, no. And I was looking at it, I was like, yeah, I'm more of a lover than a fighter.
That was a nice shot though. The way that shot sort of developed and we, you know, the camera sort of panned over and all that action happened. Then we ended up at the bunk and it sort of came under my arm. My arm was up high and we're kind of looking around like this.
Yeah.
And then it pushed into a profile close up ultimately. And then that became the coverage.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a masterclass that Rick Colby taught in terms of directing and the shot design and staging and all
camera
everything
movement.
He did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. I remember like I would take notes and I watched that episode as he directed it. It was a masterclass. Very well done.
Yeah. I mean, I love that when a director can construct a shot that tells a story and then it transitions from a master. So we know where we are. Into coverage. And he did that all through this episode.
All throughout. Yes. Yep. So the rescue team comes down. You're gonna leave some breadcrumbs. Mm-hmm. And so you see Chakotay and Tuvok sort of walking across this cave and it looks massive. You see foreground rocks, and then all of a sudden, Garrett, you step into the foreground in a close up and you're punching some buttons and setting your what are they called?
They're called subspace transponders.
Subspace transponder. But my takeaway from that moment was a couple of things, and I think I always look at things like a director these days, but we had one set of caves. It was basically like that room where the transponders were getting set down, and it had a little balcony, and then we had a short exit out one side and a longer exit out the other, and that was it. And we shot the same caves for 7 years. And so I was very impressed because I remember the size of that when I looked at Rick's shot again. The way he designed the shot makes it look like this massive, beautiful underground thing. And it's not. It was not that big. Like he was showing every inch of it. If he had turned the camera a little bit, you would have seen off the set.
Over the 7 years, Ensign Kim has done a lot of sticking stuff onto walls and bulkheads and turning them on. And I don't know if it happened in this episode, but many times that double stick tape didn't do too well. And I'd stick it on, it would just fall right off. And I had to cut, do that again, you know? So there was, you know, there's some fine art to getting this just right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to love Kim.
Especially in rocks. I mean, because,
totally flat surface.
It's not a smooth surface.
That's right.
The other thing I noticed about those caves is all that dripping water. Did you notice dripping water around?
Mm-hmm. Well, no.
There was a lot of dripping water early, and then it sort of stopped later on. But in that first sequence, there was dripping water everywhere.
Okay.
And I was like, well, I wonder why they did dripping water. And then I realized it's the same caves week after week after week. So they would change some detail to make it seem like a different set. So this week, you know, there was dripping water. Next week, they might add cobwebs everywhere.
Right.
Could they light it differently?
Yeah, they may light it.
Very blue in this.
Yeah. They'll do things exactly like that. Like it's got to be they have to come up with something week to week or else you start seeing the same little 20-foot caves and the same colors and...
The barracks are so damn close to the operational controls, and there's nothing like shielding. There's no type of like protection from like any prisoner can walk up and just start tapping away, which is what B'Elanna does. And it's like, geez, these Badeans, how advanced they are. Wouldn't they have just hit a button that said force field? You can't force come field. In here. Yeah, yeah. They would have done that, but they left everything wide open.
Even then a sign that said keep out.
Keep out. Yeah.
Anything.
Beware of the Vidian dog is what it should have said right there. Yeah. But no, there's nothing. And then that whole scene where, Robbie, you're sitting there with B'Elanna and the Vidian guards come in. And you're like, hey, she's just taking a rest. She's sick. And then he's like, well, then we'll take her back to the barracks. And you're like, no. And then B'Elanna says, but this is the funny thing. B'Elanna turns to you and says, like, it's fine. It's fine, Paris. Maybe I can figure out how to, you know, get into the controls and contact the ship. And she says it right in front,
of the guards.
The guards are right there. And I'm like, don't you know how to go sotto voce? Can you go a little bit lower in voice? And you're telling Robbie what you're about to do, which is clearly being heard by the guards, which are like 1 foot away from you. So that was one of my like little weird things I noticed.
I loved what Roxanne did with the human version of B'Elanna. It was so vulnerable and so, you just empathize so authentically with what she was doing, because it was such great work she did there. And I thought that vulnerability, and it made me think in a bigger picture, as we've been watching so many episodes. Mm-hmm. Every time you see, you know, as in this first season of Voyager, every time the writers allowed a character to really go deeply in some vulnerability, like the Doctor did with Kes and some of those things, or Kes gets vulnerable, or Janeway gets vulnerable. Whenever a character gets vulnerable, that character grows for the audience exponentially. Mm-hmm. And so this was such a great opportunity. Like, without this story, I think B'Elanna may have, you know, grown for the audience's experience and feeling close and attached. It would have been a much slower process. This just like shot her so deeply into the hearts of the audience, I think, because you just see that vulnerability and you understand.
And everything was, he allowed it, number one, for the two of you to be close. Yeah. There was never any need to project anything. So you had this little private conversation that we were able to eavesdrop on, which mm-hmm. was amazing. I think I put it down here. I said, great scene, Roxanne, Robbie, touching on the shame in reference to race mm-hmm. and appearance. And I just want to go back one sec, because I think we passed over it. It really hit me. It said, I have infected you. And I said, hard not to feel the resonance of the phage, COVID, vax, a guy who's out there trying to find a vaccine. There was something, what I love about this is that it's not like good guy, bad guy.
Yeah.
That we're sort of let in on this being's need. And I felt, again, with everything that's happening now, mm-hmm. I felt like that was very resonant for me.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up that moment, because I didn't write a note down. And the reason I didn't is it was such a kind of shocking moment. I think I was literally taken aback, because of course I know B'Elanna is not going to die. Because I couldn't remember this episode, I was like, oh my God, I forgot that you had infected her with this horrible, and there you are, this looking like a monster, and look, you know, the makeup, and I feel like the Vidians were the best villain that we created in 7 years. I wish they had become our arch nemesis throughout the whole 7 years, because it's the kind of villain that has I think we talked about it a little before the show, Garrett, but like there's a horror quality to it. There's a tragic sadness to what they're going through. And then for him to say, you know, how will you know, Doc, if I can survive it? Oh, because I infected you with the phage. What?
Yeah.
Blew me away.
I also wrote down extreme excruciating joint pain.
Yes, you did. which in my age, all of our ages, we've all felt joint pain.
Excruciating joint pain. Okay. Yeah. And?
Exactly.
Oh.
No, I was just going to say that if they ever make if they're ever able to do a Voyager movie, the Vidians would be great to bring back. And Brian is still alive at the end of this thing, so he could definitely.
Yeah.
He's broken. Brokenhearted, but he's alive.
Yeah, you killed your love, is what happened at the end.
Yeah. I didn't get any chance to experience that voracious sexual appetite she was talking about.
Now that was awkward to me.
It was.
That was a little awkward. It came out of nowhere too for me. I was like, wait a minute, what? She's not. Oh my God, she's saying it happened so fast.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, she's trying anything to get loose, right? She's thinking, if I can seduce this guy right now, and he takes
there's another one of those contradictions. Mm-hmm. So we've got these incredible shackles, and just by shaking the table, you can come on. The bolt can shake loose.
Oh, but I dare to think about what would a Vidian phallus look like. I mean, would there be 17 versions? I mean, like pieces of phalluses of all these aliens. All
I have one.
You have
some.
You have one right there.
Wow!
And he pulls it out. That's amazing, Brian.
Amazing.
You kept it all these years.
And then here's the other note I have, Robbie.
Yeah.
So when he comes and steals Durst's face.
Yes.
Why didn't he take you? You're so much better looking. You've got this beautiful blonde-haired god, Adonis, and no, we're going to take the small Jewish guy. That'll do.
That'll get her.
That's what I said. What did I put down here? I was like, why didn't they take?
Well, you know.
Why wouldn't they take handsome Paris's face?
And Paris volunteered. You saw him.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm the senior officer. Don't take Durst. Take me. And
the
then Deans. They're like, no, we want that guy. We stupid, want him.
Stupid race. No one. Stupid, he told us race. To go get the best looking guy. Well,
will this do? You were a very handsome young man. It was funny to see both of us. I mean.
Yes, we were.
Now, Brian and I became very good friends maybe 5 years ago on a show called Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, where we sort of reconnected up in Vancouver. But crazy to look at young versions.
We were all hot young things.
Right? Did Nancy watch it with you? Nancy's as well?
No, Nancy was Nancy's on vacation with her girlfriend. She'll
be
back in the next couple hours. But she has seen it.
And she has seen it.
Yeah.
So she's in the midst of Girlfriend's Guide to Vacation right now, is what she's doing.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
So there is I'm gonna digest for a moment, digress into looking at old things. Just a couple days ago, there's a director named Paul Lazarus. Did you ever work with Paul?
Mm-hmm. I've worked with Paul.
Paul was a theater director in New York. That's how I first met him. And then he directed a lot of comedies and TV shows. And I heard from Paul about a week ago. He said, hey, I was cleaning out my house. I found this videotape that was the production of Antigone that I directed with you at Lincoln Center in 1985.
Wow.
I've got a videotape of that production. Do you want to see it? And I was like, absolutely.
Yes.
So I just watched it a couple of days ago. And it's just crazy. This old VHS crackly thing of this production. Like, how lucky are we to have some, like, our lives still recorded? I mean, I guess a lot of people do in their own home movies and things like that. But I just felt like how lucky that Paul had found this. One of my classmates from school, I forgot she was even in the production. And there she is as a young, you know, we're all our young 20-something, 21, 22 years old.
Oh, that's amazing.
Crazy.
Going back to what Brian was saying about why didn't they take the handsome, good-looking Mr. Paris, this is a comment that I've heard a lot at conventions. Fans will come up and say, the Voyager cast was just too good-looking. And it's really weird because when I watch, you know, when I watch Roxanne on screen without her Klingon makeup, she is a really attractive woman.
Stunning.
She's a stunning woman. And if you look across the board, right, if you look across the board and you're looking at Chakotay, he's a really good looking Latino guy.
Yeah,
you're a good looking white dude, right? Janeway she has a really pretty face, you know, for an Irish American. Across the board, I never thought of that, of us being like the best looking cast. But in reality, they really cast some people that really are very handsome face-wise, you know what I'm saying?
But more than anything else, you guys also had, they cast actors. They cast actors that had some gravitas, which was like, which is always what I get it. Yes, they're great looking. But back in the day, you look at the original show, William Shatner was held up as, they were all beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they were all.
Yeah.
So yes, I agree with them, but.
Yeah.
So what?
So what?
Can you be too good looking?
I gotta say, not only were you good looking, Brian, but you were very Sulan. I'm gonna say Sulan.
Okay.
I don't know. Now you've got me all confused, Garrett.
Sulan.
Yeah.
He was very sensitive. He was very sensitive.
I think he was.
Yeah.
Almost too sensitive. I wish going back, I would have liked to have sort of spined him up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So you go steal Durst's face, which is really your face.
Yeah.
And I feel like they hired an actor who could look like Durst, and then they put a whole prosthetic of your face on your face. Yeah. Was there any of your real face there, or was it because it seemed raised?
No. What they did was they just did a life mask of me, whatever that was, and they just took that prosthetic of Brian's face and put it right over the face.
Wow, that I did not know. I thought that was your actual face peeking out and everything else was put around it. No, that was actually a prosthetic of your face on your face.
I was much thinner than that bloated mask. Oh, dare you, Garrett?
It was split over here. It was all kind of, it was like wide and flattened and
like I am now, but not that then.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, Brian. Please forgive me.
No, please. This is so much fun.
So we go back to the ship and then they've done some analysis and they realize that when this thing changes, there's a micro fissure and we can maybe. Again, I'm going to say Captain Janeway makes a risky choice. I've had enough of her lately watching these episodes. She's putting people at risk. She's like, maybe if we time it right, we can beam somebody through a micro fissure and we'll have to change the amplitude of the transporter beam. And these guys may be dead and now you're going to kill somebody else, sticking them through a micro fissure in a amplitude party. I don't know.
Robbie, without my notes, I'm so sorry. All I can do is criticize your pronunciation of things. What? Is it Fisher or Fissure? Microfissure.
No.
I'm going to say Fissure. Microfissure. Like microfissure.
Fissure.
Okay. You know what, Robbie?
South thing too.
If you want to zhuzh it up, you can zhuzh it up.
Yeah, I'm going to zhuzh. I'm going to go with some zhuzh.
Fissure. Okay.
Fissure. They go through the micro fissure.
Yes.
And they catch some fish. No. and then Chakotay gets turned into a Vidian.
Vidian Chakotay.
Yeah, love Vidian it. Chakotay. I totally forgot about that.
I forgot about that too.
Yeah.
I did.
So Chakotay had to put on this stuff. Mm-hmm. He had to put on. I never remembered that.
Yeah.
And who'd have thought that Tuvok was so good with a needle and thread?
Yes, exactly.
Just, all of a sudden he brings in, like, I just whipped something up in the back.
Yeah.
And they're like, damn.
Yeah.
There was some joke about being a tailor.
Paris says it. Paris says, like, maybe you can be a, didn't you say something?
Yeah,
like
I think
that?
So.
You said maybe you could be the tailor or something right now. That could be your other occupation.
And it fits perfectly.
It was so good. Who knew he was such a good cosplay creator, right? So,
yeah,
no kidding.
I made a note about, and I may have mentioned this already, but just how seriously Roxanne took all this. And I remember her, she had a ton of questions. She drove Rick Colby crazy. I'll be honest. Rick Colby was like, he was so frustrated with her. And I think now I have a memory of Ken Miller being on the set. And that is such a rare memory on Star Trek that any writer
would be there. Yeah.
But Ken was, as we said earlier, bottom rung. So he was a junior guy. So he's got reasons to want to be there and look out for his script and make sure it's done right. But I remember Roxanne talking to Ken on the set. I remember them huddling and rewriting things and Ken having to go to the hotline. Remember, we didn't have cell phones really. I mean, I guess we did, but there was a stage phone that was literally a red color on the wall. And you would go pick up the red phone And as soon as you picked it up, it would start dialing the production office.
Yeah.
And so you could call the writers. So if you had a question for the office or for the writers or anything, you'd go over to the wall, you'd pick up the red phone, and it just starts ringing.
Yeah. To call the president.
And I remember Roxanne did that a lot on this episode. Wow. And Rick Colby was apoplectic. He was very frustrated, I remember.
Yeah, we talked a lot when we were in the chairs, and I had worked with her before. We did an episode of a series called Equal Justice.
What?
You remember Equal Justice?
Oh yeah, yeah. The incredible launched a ton of people, but so we had worked together before, and nice. But I do remember that she, I absolutely remember that this was that.
She has lots of questions,
but it's a revelation for me, because that wasn't her normal MO, was it?
No.
So this, obviously she was shocking the monkey a little bit with this.
Yeah. I mean, she always was prepared and professional, and she did her work and her homework, but this was like nuclear version of that. This was beyond any kind of preparation. This was constant second guessing, and
it was a huge episode for her, and she really had to lay herself open.
Yeah.
So,
by the way, they're in the caves, and Klingon cooks a rodent. She says, "I killed this rodent."
I killed
it. It was clearly, Rebecca looked at it. She goes, "That's chicken. That's a chicken breast.
It's a chicken breast.
Come on."
Our boneless thigh.
We all know that is not a rodent.
Not only does it taste like chicken, but it looks like chicken too. I made the same note when I had notes, and I said that, boy, that rodent must have been so big. It was similar to the Princess Bride, where the R-O-U-S's rodents of unusual size. It must have been massive for it to be got this whole breast of chicken that you're eating. So
it's fantastic.
So the ladies come back and they start playing with the computer, and the warning goes off, and there's a little bit of a shootout. Chakotay shows up, and then Doc, I'm going to say Doc, I'm not going to say S-U-L-A-N because I don't know how to say it. So the Doc comes in and he fires his weapon, but B'Elanna, Klingon B'Elanna, dives in front and is mortally wounded. And that, like I said, clearly before Brian, I felt this doctor was sensitive, and he was emotional, and he was vulnerable, and I felt all of that so well. You did such great work to bring that kind of empathy for that character. As evil as he was, my heart broke for him. And then when you killed this woman that you had strong feelings for, and that scream was just heartbreaking. So.
It was an exercise in trust to when you can't hear yourself and you can't really see, you really just sort of throw the stuff against the wall and hope that something sticks.
Yeah. Well, it worked. It stuck. It was good.
It stuck.
Hey, we did skip one thing. When before the cave, before they eat the chicken, that's really the rodent that's a chicken. I loved when Klingon B'Elanna throws human B'Elanna over her shoulder and just triumphantly walks out like, look at my prize, it's my human self. I'm gonna take this damsel in distress away.
Yeah.
It was great. I love that shot. It was a good one.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Oh, did you notice the very end scene where B'Elanna is talking to Chakotay, and they have a close-up on Chakotay, and they come in with that native flute music at the end, like, I don't know if you caught that.
Don't get me started on that.
You're pouring, pouring gasoline on the fire, Garrett.
There was no flute. There was no flute. It was a violin. Sorry.
Okay, good.
I loved all the stuff, the disintegration of B'Elanna, and it sort of smacked of Freud and the ego versus the id, and all that great stuff. One thing in that scene, when they throw B'Elanna back in, or they grab her, what's with like the Vidian Shecky Green? He says, we're gonna give you a shower and a hot meal.
Oh yeah.
Where are you taking me? Shower and a hot meal.
I didn't know if that meant like, I didn't know if that was like a
code like for
the last organ meal, like you're gonna organ, yeah,
the organ transplant time.
Yeah, well, like, well, yeah, because then it smacks of what are we talking? I'm taking you to
Holocaust
the,
or
the
something.
Gas, yeah.
Yes, yeah, a little bit of that.
It was,
too.
But it was that, or it was like it you was know, like, Waka Waka Waka. It was Fozzie Bear.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know.
It yeah, it bumped me too.
Good.
I don't
good
know exactly why, but it's when those kind of things happen, you're like your radar goes up, like something.
And then here's one more question.
Yes. Yeah.
What about Durst? Like what? Like Durst is dead. One of two people. And
yeah, I know they never nobody, talk about it.
Nobody pours, you know, some malt liquor on the ground for Durst.
I know.
Nobody says, "Oh, Durst." It's like everybody's.
I know. On, you're right.
Durst. I'm gonna say cheers and here's to this, Durst.
Here's yeah. to Durst.
I feel yes.
Last week.
Cheers. Sorry,
cheers. Cheers. We watched Cathexis. Where Durst was introduced, and there was one scene on the bridge. One scene on the bridge where the director had decided to stage us all kind of huddled in a corner.
It's a four shot. It's like Durst, Paris, Kim, and Janeway, and
you can see that like we were told to like find the camera, and so we're all sort of like leaning over. This like way or that.
If I turn this way, and my head would be right here.
It's work.
Yeah.
Every actor's dream, though, man, to be on that bridge and actually get hit by something and have to do the thing.
The I thought the that yes, I thought,
had such trouble with that. I thought I was asking you like what do you move? What do you like?
I think I remember us talking about that, like because you were nerd, and we had gotten reprimanded for bad shakes after the pilot. We got sent a whole tape
by Kim Friedman.
Next generation doing shakes and phaser hits and
DS9 clips. Yeah, it's Kim Friedman, and she just told us, you know, I'm directing your episode when you come back from break after shooting the pilot. None of you know how to shake correctly.
It was a really aggressive letter. I gotta.
That's insane.
If anyone could find that letter.
Oh, I wish I had that letter.
Find that somewhere just to be able to.
I must have fired up the softball league, huh? Yeah.
But I tell you what though, when you I remember that on the bridge when you said like, how do I do this? It made me feel so good. I felt like a veteran all of a sudden. I'm like, oh, let me explain.
Watch this.
Yes.
Brian, one thing that I asked Robbie when we first started this, I asked him, what was your first impression of me when you first met me? And I'm going to tell you what mine was of yours. And so I want to ask you, Brian, when you came on the set, what were your first impressions from Cathexis when you were first introduced, when you first met? I mean, obviously you had worked with Roxanne Dawson before, mm-hmm. but you'd never worked with the rest of us as far as I'm concerned. Is that correct?
No, I don't believe I'd ever worked with anybody else.
Okay.
It was a fantastic set. I really loved it. I will say I remember this conversation that you and I had, Garrett, which it warms my heart. I still tell it because we were how many episodes in? We were
12, 13.
Cathexis. No. Okay, so I was asking you like how is the marathon going? And you were like, oh, it's great, but you know, I'm waiting. Like, when is the other shoe going to drop? Like, I'm nervous that I'm not. That I said, dude, you're gonna, you got seven seasons of this. I called it. I said, do you not realize the machine that you're now a part of? You were like, well, I'm worried. I don't know. Am I going to have to go back and get work or you know? And I was like, dude, you're at Star Trek. Yeah. I remember that conversation. It was
so
great.
I was anxious about the future. Is that what it was?
Yeah, you were anxious about the future. Like, I don't like, I mean, this is, I love this. I don't know if it was your first regular role, but you.
It is. It was.
Yeah. And so you had no idea of what's next. Like, I love the feeling of this. And I said, dude, you trust it. You got at least seven seasons. You guys were incredibly welcoming. I feel like the sign of a great set, and I've had a one and a two by my name before, and when you're one of those people, mm-hmm. you have a choice to welcome your day players and your guest stars in, or you can be very standoffish. And there was nobody. I never felt that. I never felt that in any of the incarnations. So if a fish smells from the head, they were doing something right, because you guys all were very, very welcoming. There was there was still laughter. It wasn't a heavy set. Like I've worked on Mad Men. I love that set, but it's a heavy set.
Yeah. Mm.
There was a real sense of camaraderie. You guys were still early enough in the run where nobody was like, got this. Everybody was trying to make this thing work. What is this thing? So I enjoyed coming to work every day.
Awesome.
When you talk about sets and series regulars having a choice of either being welcoming or the other way, the standoffishness. I obviously have never experienced a standoffishness, but in terms of, I had a friend of mine who said he was working on ER, and he said that was the most standoffish set he had ever been on. Like, none of the series regulars talked to the guest stars at all. It was just like, we don't have time for you. So that to me is definitely a very foreign concept, to think of all the series regulars being standoffish like that. So I'm happy that we were very open and welcoming to you. And I always felt that our set was had open arms policy, where we never treated anybody like crap.
All the bad stuff, all that stuff is all based on insecurity. And and anyway, I understand it. I never take it personally, because when I show up on a set, I show up, you know, just, I'm so happy to be there. I love working. And when I don't see that, it's an aberration more than, you know.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
It should be a wonderful experience every time you walk on.
Every podcast we talk about the underlying message. Gene Roddenberry really, he had the overlying synopsis where they go down the planet, this happens, yada yada, but there's always something that
moral.
A lesson to learn. Exactly. So what is the lesson?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think the theme for me is in B'Elanna's story, and it's to have true awareness of all the parts of ourselves, and to be able to accept all the parts of ourselves is the only way. It's like B'Elanna has a line, she says, "I've never felt so peaceful," at the very end when she's back on the ship. She says, you know, after what I've been through with my twin, I've never felt so peaceful, at peace in my body, in my life. So I think that's the lesson, is like, you have to not only find a way to accept the parts of yourself that you may not like, but you've got to find a way to love it and accept it and come to terms with it so that you can have peace, because otherwise you'll never have peace. That's my lesson.
Brian?
Oh, I think that's beautifully put. I would say the same thing, that it is about it's a reclaiming those parts of ourselves that brought us shame. And until we accept those parts of ourselves, that we cannot move forward, we cannot be whole.
Yeah.
And also there's something to be said about bearing one's fear. There's a fantastic play that George Bernard Shaw wrote about Napoleon, called The Man of Destiny, and he has this fantastic speech in there, and it's all about that every human being has these fears, these doubts, and what makes us heroic is not that we don't have them, but that we in fact have them, acknowledge them, are responsible, and bear them. So that was very resonant for me throughout this entire episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Garrett?
I'm going to say you guys were so eloquent in your responses that I'm going to pass to you guys and just, you know, I agree with that. I mean, really, that end scene when she's talking to Chakotay, she talks about, I feel incomplete, you know, without my other Klingon half, you know what I'm saying? So, and then she spent all that time trying to get away from it and ignoring it and distancing herself from that, you know, that uncouth Klingon side of herself. And now she realizes at the end of that episode that, hey, that's part of me too, right? We all have our good sides and our bad sides, but that's what makes us who we are. And to, and you're right, both of you, if you don't embrace that side of yourself that you're ashamed of, how can you move on? How can you be a complete human being? So, so thank you for both of your eloquent answers for me not.
And I have a part, I have a part two.
Yeah.
And the part two is breadcrumbs.
All right. So that is the end of our show. Thank you again, Patreon patrons, for our recap of Faces, and thank you for our special guest, Mr. Brian Markinson. Without you, this show would have not have been as good.
Oh yeah. Aww. This is a great one. Very,
this is
very
a really
good.
Fun show. Yeah,
very good show.
Yeah.
Thanks, Brian. We'll see you guys next week.
All right. Bye. See you guys next week. Bye. When we review Jitrell. See you guys.